Well, if you're a fan of listening to the weather guys, you might be interested in stepping up your weather observation game, maybe by creating your own home weather station or just keeping a weather record. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our weather guy is back with us once again, John Martin, a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and also Steve Ackerman, vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. He's also, of course, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, by the way, hello.
Hello, Larry. How you doing?
Good. John, are you with us?
I sure am. How are you, Larry?
Oh, it's great. I'm great, and great to have you back as well. So we're going to talk with them a bit today about being a citizen scientist by keeping a weather log, maybe investing in a few more tools to track weather. We also will talk about the windy November and surprisingly warm temperatures we had earlier this month, right up until just a few days ago. And we'll take your weather-related comments, observations, and questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can send us an email and maybe a photo, too. Maybe if you got a good weather photo, we always like to see that. You can send that to ideas@wpr.org. Well, many of our callers on the show are, as you guys know, they're very interested in and engaged in weather. So let's talk to begin with about some things we can all do to track weather where we live. Have either of you ever kept some sort of weather journal or log? John, did you?
I did for a short time when I was a boy. I got a weather station that was a rudimentary, told me the wind direction. I kind of looked at that every day. It was a weather vane, and then I had a decent thermometer. I was a morning paper boy when I was a kid, so I was out early every morning, and I always looked at the thermometer. So I had an idea of what the temperature was every single day. I was particularly interested in the winter time. And I'd measure how much snow we got up in northeastern Massachusetts. You get a lot of snow in the winter time. So I paid attention to all of those things. But I don't really have too many old records left. The only record that I have is the fact that I'm still doing this professionally 50-something years later. And I've never lost my interest in it. So I guess that's a record in and of itself.
Steve, what about you?
I never did what John did as a kid, entering observations in a book. I do have a weather station that, like John, I look at it every day to see what the temperature is, where the wind's coming from. It's not located in what would be considered an official site because I have too many trees, so I have it out on the dock. But I do participate in a citizen science program called COCORAHS, COCORAHS, and that stands for Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. And so that group will recommend a rain gauge. And you can, and where and how to cite it. And so I do cite that. And then when we do have precipitation, report that in. And that all gets reported and updated on the web. And they'll keep records, too, of what you put in. So I don't have to write it in a book myself.
Well, that's something others could do then, right? They get the right rain gauge and get involved with COCORAHS.
Yeah. And it's a relatively easy thing. I don't do the snowfall so much because, again, I don't have a good open site to make that measurement. So when we get to this time of the year, I have to take the rain gauge in so it doesn't freeze and break. But there is another citizen science activity associated with precipitation. It's called MPING, M-P-I-N-G. And that's an acronym for Meteorological Phenomena Identification Near the Ground Project. So we get creative with our namings. But in this case, and this works with the National Weather Service as well as University of Oklahoma. So when it's snowing outside or raining or hailing, again, you go onto your smartphone and make that observation, and then it goes to a central site. And then if you were to go to the radar imagery that the National Weather Service provides, you can see the information pop up for different observations. So if the radar says it's precipitating, the somebody who has MPIG in that area, you see a little snowflake or raindrop pop up to tell you that it's raining there or precipitating. And again, that's another useful observation, but then also the National Weather Service uses those observations against the radar observations that are coincident to try and improve the type of precipitation that's being measured by the radar.
And is there anything, how do you keep track of the snowfall? Or just maybe is it just a yardstick or what?
Yeah, I just take a ruler outside, and I just do a whole bunch of different spots. I try and get away from buildings, away from the base of trees, or underneath canopies of trees, even when they're leafless in the wintertime, and just get a whole bunch of different measurements, maybe on the end of my driveway, front edge of my lawn, and then take an average of them, because you can get a little bit of drifting here and there, and, you know, you don't want to go just – but even though I'd like to get the biggest number possible, I don't cheat. I don't go and stick a meter stick in the biggest drifted snow. So I try not to cheat, and I try and get a pretty good estimate of the snowfall that way. You got to take an average.
Yeah.
Okay. Lyman in McFarland has a question, I believe. Lyman, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a longstanding question here, and it's about the what seems to me to be the change in the appearance of sunlight as summer goes on. It seems to me that starting in August, the sun looks to be weaker and have a slightly different color compared to, say, June, even if you're looking at the sun at the same angle, like, say, you know, close to the middle of the day in August and maybe earlier or later in June. So I'm assuming the light is coming through the same amount of atmosphere if it's at the same angle. And it really seems to me that it's definitely different, you know, once August gets underway compared to June. Is this my imagination?
Well, Steve, what do you think?
I think it partly is due to your imagination. I think, you know, you're doing the right thing in terms of trying to do the comparison when the sun is at the same altitude during the two different months, as opposed to the same time of day. Because you're right, it does go up and down in the sky in terms of how high it is. Now, having said, I think it's your imagination. On the other hand, in August, we generally are more humid, and water vapor in the atmosphere will absorb solar energy. And so it's possible that it might actually be. I don't know if we would be able to sense that with our eyes as opposed to having some scientific instrumentation that might be able to do that better.
John, yeah, I agree, Steve.
Yeah,
I think you're right on. I think it's the humidity that gradually builds to a crescendo in late July, early August, probably on average. And in addition, there's fires all over the place that can give just a little bit of extra added obscurity to the air quality, the air column, as we saw kind of dramatically this year. But even in normal years, you probably get a little bit more of that. Perhaps there's more dust, agricultural seasons changing for some crops and so on. So a whole bunch of things might go into increasing ever so slightly the turbidity of the air, and then also the humidity is ever present. Whereas in June, I think you get episodic periods of high humidity because you're still emerging from the late spring. So I think those are exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Lyman, there you go. Appreciate your call very much. By the way, I want to mention, Natalie was reminding me that on our website, both those links, the MPing and the Kokoroz, we have links to those on our website. So if you go to WPR.org/Larry, you're going to find those links to those if you want to look into that for sure. So why is citizen science like this so important?
You know, one other citizen science program I'll point out, which again will really demonstrate the importance, I think, is the National Weather Service for many, many years has been running the Cooperative Observer Program. So they will train you how to make observations that are the official type of measurements that the National Weather Service needs. And so it's a true weather observing network of and by and for the people. It has almost 9,000 volunteers, I think, that make observations. And then those observations go into the National Weather Service database and then are used in making weather forecasts. Because I think we all recognize that the weather can change very rapidly, and it's very expensive for the government to measure the weather everywhere. And so with volunteers stepping up and with good instrumentation and training to make the measurements can really support the National Weather Service in their observations.
Oh, that's really cool. And that's free. They don't charge for the training.
Right.
Yeah, as well. Well, we've got Carl in Jefferson with a great question, but we need to take a look at the news. Carl, I hope you can hang on there with us. Love to have you stay with us. John Martin and Steve Ackerman are guests from both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And Steve, of course, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. They'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our guests, and we'll talk to Carl from Jefferson next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler. Thanks so much for joining us today for the Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. And great to have back Steve Ackerman and John Martin, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. We've been talking about citizen science and some recent weather events. So what weather questions are on your mind? Notice something interesting about the weather lately? Did you get some snow? Join in. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, we always love to see those weather photos as well. Carl in Jefferson's been hanging with us through the news, so let's go right there. Carl, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I've always been interested in weather, and I do have a weather station at home to record the basics, the airspeed, wind speed, humidity, temperature. But I thought I might figure out a way if I wanted to step up the game a bit. So I built a satellite receiving station here at my house here in Jefferson with some basic components, and I now receive satellite imagery from the polar orbiting NOAA satellites, as well as the geostationary GO-16 satellite. Sort of helps my weather outlook.
Wow. John?
Yeah, that is really cool. There are not many people who built their own satellite weather receiving antennas. That's great.
That's remarkable, Kyle.
Yeah, I did a presentation to the SSEC at UW back in, I think that was September, where I discussed my setup too. But it's fun, it's affordable, and surprisingly, it's a really global project. I have met people from literally every country in the world who have started building their own home receiving stations like this to receive everything from the NOAA satellites like GOES to the Russian satellites, the Fengyang Chinese satellites. So it is becoming quite popular because it's becoming quite affordable to build these.
Wow. And by affordable, I wonder what that means.
Well, I can tell you my system probably cost me under $120 to build. I use a Raspberry Pi computer, a modified Wi-Fi dish. That is actually what I use to receive the signals from the satellite. And fortunately, almost all of the software out there is developed by amateurs like me, so it's all open source and free to use.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
I think it's a real testament to the, you know, world weather community that this data is made freely available for anybody who either wants to go on the web or wants to set up their own receiving station and be able to get it, as your call's pointing out, from the U.S., from Russia, from China, from European satellites. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's a great point. And we've had a long, long history in this particular science of international cooperation and free use of data. So this is a great hallmark of our science.
And Carl sent a couple of pictures from the satellite, which are really cool pictures. Carl, that's great.
And Larry, you posted those on the website? Because I was going to ask, how does he display it? But obviously, he's turning it into imagery.
Yeah, I do a lot of the imagery, and then I also use it to do a lot of different layering with the different types of data that comes in from the GOES satellites, precipitation outlooks, and I display it, obviously, at my home computer here in Jefferson.
Well, Carl, great talking to you. Thank you. So thanks for waiting and hanging around. And those, I'll tell you what, those photos from the satellite are gorgeous, for sure. Oh, man. Ed in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ed. Thanks for calling.
Hello, guys. This is not exactly an aeronometer, but I've noted for years when there's windy weather outside, there's turbulence in my toilet water. I know this probably is not very meteorological. Maybe the water towers start bending in the wind. I don't know what caused it, but I'm curious. I don't know what causes the water. I'm not talking white caps, but it does get turbulent. Some low waves.
That's wild.
So if you guys have any idea, I'd like to hear it.
John, that's wild?
I have an idea, but it's probably crazy. I mean, maybe the house just shakes. I mean, I can feel my house move when the wind gets over 30 miles per hour. And if there's even almost imperceptible movement of the main structure of your home, maybe that moves the fixture enough to give you a little bit of a water wave in there. I don't know if that's it.
Steve, what do you think?
I have a different idea, and that is if you go on the roof of your house, and do that safely, of course, there's a pipe up there, and I think it's hooked up to the plumbing system in your house so that you have some air that can go in and out and allow the water to flow more smoothly. And so I'll bet that as the wind blows over that pipe, it's causing pressure differentials that are making the water in the toilet vibrate up and down. And if that's true, I think you can probably test it by keeping track of the wind and the direction it's coming from and see if that's related to the activity in the toilet.
Interesting.
Man, that is very interesting, Ed. So there you go. Keep track of that and see what happens. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Kevin in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, yes. I was interested in the contrails made by airplanes and how on some days I'll look up at the sky and, you know, a plane will be going and leaving a contrail and it'll just leave what I'm used to seeing as like the standard contrail, just very short, and it'll dissipate right after the plane. And how on other days, and sometimes even the same day, just later in the day, they'll look up at the sky and there'll be like these trails that go all the way across the sky. And not only that, but they seem to be spiral. They have a kind of almost a spirally pattern behind them. And some stuff that I saw online seemed to indicate that it might have to do with the humidity. And I know it's been talked about before on the radio, but I just want to see if I could get some kind of a definitive answer about what's causing these fluctuations in these trails across the sky.
Hmm. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, you have it right, Kevin. It has to do with the humidity up in the air where the aircraft is flying. So if it's too dry, then you'll only get short contrails. And if it's at the right high humidity then the contrails will stay around longer. And the longer they'll stay around, then the more they can be influenced by the environment. And so if it's a relatively calm upper air, then those contrails will just slowly spread out and can fill up a large area of the sky. If it's windy up there, then you can get twists and turns in the contrails. And I've actually seen a contrail once that was like a dashed line. And I think that was associated with the air going up and down where the contrail formed. And where the air goes down, the air gets compressed and warms, and the relative humidity decreases, which would cause the contrail to evaporate. So it's kind of, I enjoy watching them. Yeah. And my wife calls them junk clouds because they're formed by exhaust. But it kind of tells you what's going on way up 30,000 feet above us.
Interesting. Thank you. Jeff in Superior, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to take your thoughts to one of the previous caller's ideas that when I was a kid standing on the shore of Lake Superior at Wisconsin Point, I often wondered, because of the curvature of the earth, how the lake could be so calm. So like, for example, Saturday morning, I saw the sunrise, and the Lake Superior was like glass. There was hardly any movement in the water. And of course, it was so windy on Sunday. It makes me wonder, I know you got air pressure, and I know you got wind from the east or from the west, but it seems like the waves are about the same, whether the wind is blowing from any direction. And one would think when you're a little kid that the waves would be higher on the other side of the lake and lower on my side of the lake if the wind was blowing toward the east. What do you think about that?
Oh, John, question, comment?
Yeah, I think, you know, any portion of Lake Superior that you or I can see from the shore is an infinitesimally small part of Lake Superior. So that's one thing to keep in mind, is that it's so huge that entirely different weather regimes are going on in another part of the lake. So there's all manner of factors that can lead to whether or not the in your own local area that the lake has a really turbid look to it, a turbulent look to it, or a glassy one. I think the glassy one's probably more uncommon. Is that right? I don't live near one of those giant Great Lakes, but I would guess the glassy Great Lake perspective is probably unusual compared to the one where, you know, it's just a little bit wavy or more than that. So, you know, I think it's just the fact that there's so much water involved and there's such interesting smaller and larger scale phenomena going on at the same time across such a huge expansive area that it's difficult to have a definitive answer about what is it that leads to the complexion of the lake out your window.
Mm. Thanks for that question. Todd in Clevenville, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Hello. I kind of follow the weather pretty closely. I go on the NOAA website, and they have weather discussion afterwards where they kind of set up why the forecast is the way it is. And they always talk about, like, the troughs coming in and the winds at the 950 millibar level are dropping down. So I was wondering, is there a way that a person can translate when they talk about millibars? Is it translate directly to altitude? I know it has to do with pressure. But is there a way a person can get to sort of a handle on it, understand it, what's affecting around you?
Yeah, Steve?
Yeah.
Go ahead, John. I know you got a good answer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, John, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you can get a reasonable translation of what those various pressure levels mean. First, on the very largest scale, 700 millibars is about 3 kilometers above sea level. 500 is about 5.5 kilometers. 300, the jet level is about 9 kilometers. But if you find on our department website, which is aos.wisc.edu, you go to weather, one of the options underneath the weather menu option is observation maps. And there's a set of observation maps that are constant pressure observation maps. So all those different levels, 700, 500, 300 millibars. And if you look at any one of those, and they're all images, you just click on them, look at any one of them, the solid black lines on those maps will indicate how many meters above sea level that particular pressure level was found in a given location. So if one of the lines comes through Madison or if they're southern Wisconsin, you can look, follow it, and then get the label on it. You can figure out how high above sea level that day that particular pressure level was found. And as I mentioned, they'll routinely be in a small range, but they will vary from day to day what exactly the translation would be. But that's one way that you can get it.
Hmm. And what was the site again, the website?
It's our department website, aos.wisc.edu.
aos.wisc.edu, okay.
Yeah, and one of the options is weather, and that's you click on the weather option when you get to the landing page, and then there'll be observation maps. When you get to that next landing page and observation maps, you can hit upper level maps, and you'll find it.
There you go, Todd. Thank you. Sharon in Minocqua, it's your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Larry. This is another wonderful program. I'm calling with a kind of a comment as well as a question. We can't talk about weather in Wisconsin without mentioning Increase Lapham from Milwaukee, who kind of started the National Weather Service program. But and he's just a very interesting person. He was interested in so many different things. But your previous caller who talked about his satellite set up in his house reminded me of Increase Lapham and the ingenuity of Wisconsinites. But I have a question about barometric pressure. It kind of leads to, you know, follows the previous, you know, person's conversation. I lived in Hawaii for a while, and my roommate had a really, really hard time when there would be changes in barometric pressure. It would really impact her health. And we set up a little station to measure the barometric pressure, because where we lived, it was kind of up in the mountains, it didn't seem to be, the pressure wasn't very reliable, what was being reported through the news, because I think there's just variations in pressure depending upon where you live and because we were elevated. So I don't know if there's any research that's on how barometric pressure can impact people's health as well as their maybe their mood.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know there's been studies for correlation between individuals and pressure changes. The one that I'm thinking of was occurring in Europe, and it had to do with the wind as it blew over the Alps. So it was people who lived around the Alps. And it affected some people, and it didn't affect others as well. So I think there's a correlation that probably related to the individual's, physiological. Yeah, physiological. Thank you.
Easy for you.
And that's why it's probably. Yeah. And that's probably why it's so hard, because you know the human body just changes so much between individuals. That's probably why it's hard to see what the causation is as opposed to the correlation. But it doesn't surprise me that you would, being in Hawaii up in a mountain, you know, the pressure variations are going to change a lot depending on how the wind is blowing, how strong it is, and the direction that it's coming from.
Interesting. Sharon, thank you. Appreciate that call. Staying on barometric pressure here and measuring for a minute, Jamie from Green Bay emailed, a couple of months ago, they observed their barometer measuring a rise in pressure, and then it rained. It seems counterintuitive. Shouldn't it rain when the pressure drops?
Generally, yes. When there's large-scale weather systems that are invading your area, you'll find the pressure is falling as the clouds increase, and you might therefore have decreasing pressure as rain sets in. But it depends on what the circumstances are on a given day. You can have a convective shower that might develop and produce a pressure perturbation that's positive at the ground because it's got, you know, really cold, dense air that's been cooled by evaporation hitting the ground, and your pressure goes up just as the rain shower hits you. So if I had to make a guess, summertime events might have a little bit less adherence to the rule that the pressure falls as precipitation is on the way in, because the weather systems that are involved in summertime precipitation have shorter lifetimes and can do some funny things to the local thermodynamics and the local pressure field.
Jen and John emailed in. They're looking for a recommendation for a weather station for home use.
Boy, that's a good question. I'm going to list name, I think, four companies that generally produce good quality weather stations at relatively affordable prices, and a variety of prices. One is Davis, one is La Crosse, and then there's Oregon, and then Campbell Scientific, although that might be more on the pricey edge. I haven't looked at Campbell in a while. But those are four companies that generally produce good weather stations at, for home use.
All right. So quick, give them to me once more.
Davis, D-A-V-I-S. The second is La Crosse, like the city in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
The third is Oregon, like the other city in Wisconsin. Not that they're related to the cities. And then Campbell Scientific. But Campbell Scientific may be a more high-end weather station.
All right. So there you go, Jen and John. I hope you enjoy it. Hope you find your weather station. Greg emailed to say he uses NexRad Southern Wisconsin, Northern Illinois Reflective Composite Loop. Why is there a persistent return in Eastern Dodge County? He sent the image. You may not be able to see that image, though.
Yeah, I can't see the image, but I would guess it's one of two things. One is a geography feature, so it's hitting a mountain. A lot of times they're able to take that out. More commonly, and you see this with the Sullivan radar as well, looking to the north, as windmills are going up for energy, as those farms go up, as they institute them, they're really big, and radars can now hit those, and so you'll see the wind farm. And again, it'll be the same thing. It's always there, and it's definitely, you know, not a meteorological phenomena. So I'll bet it's a wind farm.
I want to go back to the weather station for a minute. Scott had emailed for on a recommendation. He says he's gone through many of the La Crosse accurate weather stations like they see in the stores like Walmart, but they don't last longer than a year for him. Over 10 years ago, he finally decided to buy a more expensive unit called the Davis Vantage View. It costs about $300, but it's lasted over 10 years so far and no problems and still going strong. It displays current conditions and stores temps, highs and lows, wind speeds and directions, humidity, dew point, and so forth for a month, I believe. Can be hooked up to the internet for an additional cost as well. So there you go with his comment. And, oh, my gosh, I'm looking at the clock here. We are about out of time. Boy, the time flew. Lots of good questions today, John and Steve. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. You're not here with us in December, but back January 25th. So thanks again, and we'll see you in January.
All right. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much. John Martin and Steve Ackerman from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve's also Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. Tomorrow at 11, we talk with a pediatrician with a children's librarian expertise about the importance of reading with children of any age. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.